Penguin Audio presents The Long Walk by Stephen King. Writing is Richard Bachman. Read by Kirby Hayborn. The Importance of Being Bachman by Stephen King. This is my second introduction to the so-called Bachman books, a phrase which has come to mean, in my mind at least, the first few novels published with the Richard Bachman name. The ones which appeared as unheralded paperback originals under the Signet imprint. My first introduction wasn't very good. To me it reads like a textbook case of author obfuscation. But that is not surprising. When it was written, Bachman's alter ego, me, in other words, wasn't in what I'd call a contemplative or analytical mood. I was, in fact, feeling robbed. Bachman was never created as a short-term alias. He was supposed to be there for the long haul, and when my name came out in connection with his, I was surprised, upset, and pissed off. That's not a state conducive to good essay writing. This time, I may do a little better. Probably the most important thing I can say about Richard Bachman is that he became real. Not entirely, of course, he said with a nervous smile. I am not writing this in a delusive state. Except, well, maybe I am. Delusion is, after all, something writers of fiction try to encourage in their readers, at least during the time that the book or story is open before them, and the writer is hardly immune from this state of, what shall I call it? How does directed delusion sound? At any rate, Richard Bachman began his career not as a delusion, but as a sheltered place where I could publish a few early works which I felt readers might like. Then he began to grow and come alive, as the creatures of a writer's imagination so frequently do. I began to imagine his life as a dairy farmer, his wife, the beautiful Claudia Inez Bachman, his solitary New Hampshire mornings spent milking the cows, getting the wood and thinking about his stories. His evenings spent writing, always with a glass of whiskey beside his Olivetti typewriter. I once knew a writer who would say his current story or novel was putting on weight, if it was going well. In much the same way, my pen name began to put on weight. Then, when his cover was blown, Richard Bachman died. I made light of this in the few interviews I felt required to give on the subject, saying that he'd died of cancer of the pseudonym. But it was actually shock that killed him. The realization that sometimes people just won't let you alone. To put it in more fulsome, but not at all inaccurate, terms, Bachman was the vampire side of my existence, killed by the sunlight of disclosure. My feelings about all this were confused enough, and fertile enough, to bring on a book, a Stephen King book, that is, The Dark Half. It was about a writer whose pseudonym, George Stark, actually comes to life. It's a novel my wife has always detested, perhaps because, for Thad Beaumont, the dream of being a writer overwhelms the reality of being a man. For Thad, delusive thinking overtakes rationality completely, with horrific consequences. I didn't have that problem, though, really. I put Bachman aside, and although I was sorry that he had to die, I would be lying if I didn't say I felt some relief as well. The books in this omnibus were written by a young man who is angry, energetic, and deeply infatuated with the art and craft of writing. They weren't written as Bachman books, per se. Bachman hadn't been invented yet, after all, but in a Bachman state of mind. Low rage, sexual frustration, crazy good humor, and simmering despair. Ben Richards, the scrawny pre-tubercular protagonist of The Running Man, he is about as far from the Arnold Schwarzenegger character in the movie as you can get, crashes his hijacked plane into the network game skyscraper, killing himself, but taking hundreds, maybe thousands, of free V executives with him. This is the Richard Bachman version of a happy ending. The conclusions of the other Bachman novels are even more grim. Stephen King has always understood that the good guys don't always win, see Cujo, Pet Sematary, and, perhaps, Christine, but he has also understood that mostly they do. Every day in real life, the good guys win. Mostly these victories go unheralded. Man arrives home safe from work yet again, wouldn't sell many papers. But they are nonetheless real for all that, and fiction should reflect reality. And yet, in the first draft of The Dark Half, I had Thad Beaumont quote Donald E. Westlake, a very funny writer who has penned a series of very grim crime novels under the name Richard Stark. Once asked to explain the dichotomy between Westlake and Stark, the writer in question said, "I write Westlake stories on sunny days. When it rains, I'm Stark." I don't think that made it into the final version of The Dark Half, but I have always loved it, and related to it, as it has become fashionable to say. Bachman, a fictional creation who became more real to me with each published book which bore his byline, was a rainy day sort of guy, if ever there was one. The good folks mostly win. Courage usually triumphs over fear. The family dog hardly ever contracts rabies. These are things I knew at 25, and things I still know now, at the age of 25 times two. But I know something else as well. There's a place in most of us where the rain is pretty much constant. The shadows are always long, and the woods are full of monsters. It is good to have a voice in which the terrors of such a place can be articulated and its geography partially described, without denying the sunshine and clarity that fill so much of our ordinary lives. In Thinner, Bachman spoke for the first time on his own. It was the only one of the early Bachman novels that had his name on the first draft instead of mine. And it struck me as really unfair that just as he was starting to talk with his own voice, he should have been mistaken for me. And a mistake was just what it felt like, because by then Bachman had become a kind of id for me. He said the things I couldn't, and the thought of him out there on his New Hampshire dairy farm, not a best-selling writer who gets his name in some stupid Forbes list of entertainers too rich for their own good, or his face on the Today Show, or doing cameos in movies. Quietly writing his books gave him permission to think in ways I could not think, and speak in ways I could not speak. And then these news stories came out saying, Bachman is really king, and there was no one, not even me, to defend the dead man, or to point out the obvious, that King was also really Bachman, at least some of the time. Unfair I thought then, and unfair I think now, but sometimes life bites you a little, that's all. I determined to put Bachman out of my thoughts and my life, and so I did. For a number of years. Then while I was writing a novel, a Stephen King novel, called Desperation, Richard Bachman suddenly appeared in my life again. I was working on a Wang-dedicated word processor at that time. It looked like the Visiphone in an old Flash Gordon serial. This was paired with a marginally more state-of-the-art laser printer, and from time to time, when an idea occurred to me, I would write down a phrase or a putative title on a scrap of paper and scotch tape it to the side of the printer. As I neared the three-quarter mark on Desperation, I had a scrap with a single word printed on it. Regulators. I had had a great idea for a novel, something that had to do with toys, guns, TV, and suburbia. I didn't know if I would ever write it. Lots of those printer notes never came to anything, but it was certainly cool to think about. Then, one rainy day, a Richard Stark sort of day, as I was pulling into my driveway, I had an idea. I don't know where it came from. It was totally unconnected to any of the trivia tumbling through my head at the time. The idea was to take the characters from Desperation and put them into the Regulators. In some cases, I thought, they could play the same people. In others, they would change. In neither case would they do the same things or react in the same ways, because the different stories would dictate different courses of action. It would be, I thought, like the members of a repertory company acting in two different plays. Then an even more exciting idea struck me. If I could use the rep company concept with the characters, I could use it with the plot itself as well. I could stack a good many of the desperation elements in a brand new configuration and create a kind of mirror world. I knew even before setting out that plenty of critics would call this twinning a stunt, and they would not be wrong exactly. But, I thought, it could be a good stunt. Maybe even an illuminating stunt. One which showcased the muscularity and versatility of story, its all but limitless ability to adapt a few basic elements into endlessly pleasing variations, its prankish charm. But the two books couldn't sound exactly the same, and they couldn't mean the same, any more than an Edward Albee play and one by William Inge can sound and mean the same, even if they are performed on successive nights by the same company of actors. How could I possibly create a different voice? At first I thought I couldn't, and that it would be best to consign the idea to the Rube Goldberg bin I kept in the bottom of my mind, the one marked interesting but unworkable contraptions. Then it occurred to me that I had had the answer all along. Richard Bachman could write The Regulators. His voice sounded superficially the same as mine, but underneath there was a world of difference. All the difference between sunshine and rain, let us say. And his view of people was always different from mine, simultaneously funnier and more cold-hearted. Bart Dawes in Roadwork, my favorite of the early Bachman books, is an excellent example. Of course, Bachman was dead. I had announced that myself, but death is actually a minor problem for a novelist. Just ask Paul Sheldon, who brought Misery Chastain back for Annie Wilkes, or Arthur Conan Doyle, who brought Sherlock Holmes back from Rickenbach Falls when fans all over the British Empire clamored for him. I didn't actually bring Richard Bachman back from the dead anyway. I just visualized a box of neglected manuscripts in his basement, with The Regulators on top. Then I transcribed the book Bachman had already written. That transcription was a little tougher, but it was also immensely exhilarating. It was wonderful to hear Bachman's voice again, and what I had hoped might happen did happen. A book rolled out that was a kind of fraternal twin to the one I had written under my own name, and the two books were quite literally written back to back. The King book finished on one day, and the Bachman book commenced on the very next. They were no more alike than King and Bachman themselves. Desperation is about God. The Regulators is about TV. I guess that makes them both about higher powers, but very different ones just the same. The importance of being Bachman was always the importance of finding a good voice and a valid point of view that were a little different from my own. Not really different. I am not schizo enough to believe that. But I do believe that there are tricks all of us use to change our perspectives and our perceptions, to see ourselves new by dressing up in different clothes and doing our hair in different styles, and that such tricks can be very useful, a way of revitalizing and refreshing old strategies for living life, observing life, and creating art. None of these comments are intended to suggest that I have done anything great in the Bachman books, and they are surely not made as arguments for artistic merit. But I love what I do too much to want to go stale if I can help it. Bachman has been one way in which I have tried to refresh my craft and to keep from being too comfy and well padded. These early books show some progression of the Bachman persona, I hope, and I hope they also show the essence of that persona. Dark-toned, despairing, even when he is laughing, despairing most when he is laughing, in fact. Richard Bachman isn't a fellow I'd want to be all the time, even if he were still alive. But it's good to have that option, that window on the world, polarized though it may be. Still, as the reader works his or her way through these stories, he/she may discover that Dick Bachman has one thing in common with Thad Beaumont's alter ego, George Stark. He's not a very nice guy. And I wonder if there are any other good manuscripts, at or near completion, in that box found by the widowed Mrs. Bachman in the cellar of their New Hampshire farmhouse. Sometimes I wonder about that a lot. Stephen King, Lovell, Maine, April 16th, 1996. The Long Walk. Part 1. Starting Out. Chapter 1. An old blue Ford pulled into the guarded parking lot that morning, looking like a small, tired dog after a hard run. One of the guards, an expressionless young man in a khaki uniform and a Sam Brown belt, asked to see the blue plastic ID card. The boy in the back seat handed it to his mother. His mother handed it to the guard. The guard took it to a computer terminal that looked strange and out of place in the rural stillness. The computer terminal ate the card and flashed this on its screen. Garrity Raymond Davis, Road 1, Pownall, Maine, Androscoggin County, ID number 49-801-89. OK-OK-OK. The guard punched another button, and all of this disappeared, leaving the terminal screen smooth and green and blank again. He waved them forward.
"Don't they give the card back?" Mrs. Garrity asked. "Don't they?"
"No, Mom," Garrity said patiently.
"Well, I don't like it," she said,
pulling forward into an empty space. She had been saying it ever since they set out in the dark of 2 in the morning. She had been moaning it, actually. "Don't worry," he said, without hearing himself. He was occupied with looking and with his own confusion of anticipation and fear. He was out of the car almost before the engine's last asthmatic wheeze, a tall, well-built boy wearing a faded army fatigue jacket against the 8 o'clock spring chill. His mother was also tall, but too thin. Her breasts were almost non-existent. Token nubs. Her eyes were wandering and unsure, somehow shocked. Her face was an invalid's face. Her iron-colored hair had gone awry under the complication of clips that was supposed to hold it in place. Her dress hung badly on her body, as if she had recently lost a lot of weight.
"Ray," she said in that whispery conspirator's voice that he had come to dread. "Ray, listen."
He ducked his head and pretended to tuck in his shirt. One of the guards was eating sea rations from a can and reading a comic book. Garrity watched the guard eating and reading and thought for the 10,000th time, "It's all real." And now at last, the thought began to swing some weight.
"There's still time to change your mind."
The fear and anticipation cranked up a notch. "No, there's no time for that," he said. "The back-out date was yesterday." Still in that low conspirator's voice that he hated.
"They'd understand. I know they would. The major..."
"The major would..." Garrity began, and saw his mother wince. "You know what the major would do, Mom." Another car had finished the small ritual at the gate and had parked. A boy with dark hair got out. His parents followed, and for a moment the three of them stood in conference like worried baseball players. He, like some of the other boys, was wearing a light pack sack. Garrity wondered if he hadn't been a little stupid not to bring one himself.
"You won't change your mind?"
It was guilt. Guilt taking the face of anxiety. Although he was only 16, Ray Garrity knew something about guilt. She felt that she had been too dry, too tired, or maybe just too taken up with her older sorrows to halt her son's madness in its seedling stage, to halt it before the cumbersome machinery of the state with its guards in khaki and its computer terminals had taken over, binding himself more tightly to its insensate self with each passing day, until yesterday, when the lid had come down with a final bang. He put a hand on her shoulder.
"This is my idea, Mom. I know it wasn't yours.
He glanced around. No one was paying the slightest attention to them.
"I love you," but this way is the best, one way or the other.
It's not, she said, now verging on tears. Ray, it's not. If your father was here, he'd put a stop to—
Well, he's not, is he? He was brutal, hoping to stave off her tears. What if they had to drag her off? He had heard that sometimes that happened. The thought made him feel cold. In a softer voice, he said, Let it go now, Mom, okay? He forced a grin. Okay, he answered for her. Her chin was still trembling, but she nodded. Not all right, but too late. There was nothing anyone could do. A light wind soughed through the pines. The sky was pure blue. The road was just ahead in the simple stone post that marked the border between America and Canada. Suddenly, his anticipation was greater than his fear, and he wanted to get going, get the show on the road.
I made these. You can take them, can't you? They're not too heavy, are they?
She thrust a foil-wrapped package of cookies at him. Yeah. He took them, and then clutched her awkwardly, trying to give her what she needed to have. He kissed her cheek. Her skin was like old silk. For a moment, he could have cried himself. Then he thought of the smiling, mustachioed face of the major, and stepped back, stuffing the cookies into the pocket of his fatigue jacket. Goodbye, Mom.
Goodbye, Ray. Be a good boy.
She stood there for a moment, and he had a sense of her being very light, as if even the light puffs of breeze blowing this morning might send her sailing away like a dandelion gone to seed. Then she got back into the car and started the engine. Garrity stood there. She raised her hand and waved. The tears were flowing now. He could see them. He waved back, and then as she pulled out, he just stood there with his arms at his sides, conscious of how fine and brave and alone he must look. But when the car had passed back through the gate, forlornness struck him, and he was only a 16-year-old boy again, alone in a strange place. He turned back toward the road. The other boy, the dark-haired one, was watching his folks pull out. He had a bad scar along one cheek. Garrity walked over to him and said hello. The dark-haired boy gave him a glance. Hi. I'm Ray Garrity, he said, feeling mildly like an asshole. I'm Peter McVries. You're ready? Garrity asked. McVries shrugged. I feel jumpy. That's the worst. Garrity nodded. The two of them walked toward the road and the stone marker. Behind them, other cars were pulling out. A woman began screaming abruptly. Unconsciously, Garrity and McVries drew closer together. Neither of them looked back. Ahead of them was the road, wide and black. That composition surface will be hot by noon, McVries said abruptly. I'm going to stick to the shoulder. Garrity nodded. McVries looked at him thoughtfully. What do you weigh?
160.
I'm 167. They say the heavier guys get tired quicker, but I think I'm in pretty good shape. To Garrity, Peter McVries looked rather more than that. He looked awesomely fit. He wondered who they were that said the heavier guys got tired quicker, almost asked, and decided not to. The walk was one of those things that existed on Apocrypha, talismans, legend. McVries sat down in the shade near a couple of other boys, and after a moment, Garrity sat beside him. McVries seemed to have dismissed him entirely. Garrity looked at his watch. It was 8:05. 55 minutes to go. Impatience and anticipation came back, and he did his best to squash them, telling himself to enjoy sitting while he could. All of the boys were sitting. Sitting in groups and sitting alone. One boy had climbed onto the lowest branch of a pine overlooking the road and was eating what looked like a jelly sandwich. He was skinny and blonde, wearing purple pants and a blue chambray shirt under an old green zip sweater with holes in the elbows. Garrity wondered if the skinny ones would last or burn out quickly. The boys he and McVries had sat down next to were talking. "I'm not hurrying," one of them said. "Why should I? If I get worn, so what? You adjust, that's all. Adjustment is the key word here. Remember where you heard that first." He looked around and discovered Garrity and McVries. "More lambs to the slaughter. Hank Olson's the name. Walking is my game." He said this with no trace of a smile at all. Garrity offered his own name. McVries spoke his own absently, still looking off toward the road. "I'm Art Baker," the other said quietly. He spoke with a very slight southern accent. The four of them shook hands all around. There was a moment's silence, and McVries said, "Kind of scary, isn't it?" They all nodded, except Hank Olson, who shrugged and grinned. Garrity watched the boy in the pine tree finish his sandwich, ball up the waxed paper it had been in, and toss it onto the soft shoulder. He'll burn out early, he decided. That made him feel a little better. "You see that spot right by the marker post?" Olson said suddenly. They all looked. The breeze made moving shadow patterns across the road. Garrity didn't know if he saw anything or not. "That's from the long walk the year before last," Olson said with grim satisfaction. "Kid was so scared, he just froze up at 9 o'clock. They considered the horror of it silently. "Just couldn't move. He took his three warnings, and then at 9:02 a.m., they gave him his ticket, right there by the starting post." Garrity wondered if his own legs would freeze. He didn't think so, but it was a thing you wouldn't know for sure until the time came, and it was a terrible thought. He wondered why Hank Olson wanted to bring up such a terrible thing. Suddenly, Art Baker sat up straight. "Here he comes." A dun-colored Jeep drove up to the stone marker and stopped. It was followed by a strange, tread-equipped vehicle that moved much more slowly. There were toy-sized radar dishes mounted on the front and back of this half-track. Two soldiers lounged on its upper deck, and Garrity felt a chill in his belly when he looked at them. They were carrying Army-type heavy-caliber carbine rifles. Some of the boys got up, but Garrity did not. Neither did Olson or Baker, and after his initial look, McVries seemed to have fallen back into his own thoughts. The skinny kid in the pine tree was swinging his feet idly. The major got out of the jeep. He was a tall, straight man with a deep desert tan that went well with his simple khakis. A pistol was strapped to his Sam Brown belt, and he was wearing reflector sunglasses. It was rumored that the major's eyes were extremely light-sensitive, and he was never seen in public without his sunglasses.
"Sit down, boys," he said. "Keep Hint 13 in mind."
Hint 13 was conserve energy whenever possible. Those who had stood sat down. Garrity looked at his watch again. It said 8:16, and he decided it was a minute fast. The major always showed up on time. He thought momentarily of setting it back a minute, and then forgot it.
"I'm not going to make a speech," the major said, sweeping them with the blank lenses that covered his eyes. "I give my congratulations to the winner among your number, and my acknowledgments of valor to the losers."
He turned to the back of the jeep. There was a living silence. Garrity breathed deep of the spring air. It would be warm, a good day to walk. The major turned back to them. He was holding a clipboard.
"When I call your name, please step forward and take your number. Then go back to your place until it is time to begin. Do this smartly, please."
"You're in the army now," Olson whispered with a grin, but Garrity ignored it.
You couldn't help admiring the major. Garrity's father, before the squads took him away, had been fond of calling the major the rarest and most dangerous monster any nation can produce, a society-supported sociopath. but he had never seen the Major in person.
Aronson?
A short, chunky farm boy with a sunburned neck gangled forward, obviously awed by the Major's presence, and took his large plastic one. He fixed it to his shirt by the pressure strip, and the Major clapped him on the back.
Abraham?
A tall boy with reddish hair and jeans and a t-shirt. His jacket was tied about his waist, schoolboy style, and flapped wildly around his knees. Olson sniggered.
Baker, Arthur.
That's me,
Baker said, and got to his feet. He moved with deceptive leisure, and he made Garrity nervous. Baker was going to be tough. Baker was going to last a long time. Baker came back. He had pressed his number 3 onto the right breast of his shirt.
Did he say anything to you? Garrity asked.
He asked me if it was commencing to come off hot down home, Baker said shyly. Yeah, the Major talked to me.
Not as hot as it's gonna commence getting up here, Olson cracked.
Baker, James, the Major said.
It went on until 8:40, and it came out right. No one had ducked out. Back in the parking lot, engines started, and a number of cars began pulling out. Boys from the backup list who would now go home and watch the long walk coverage on TV.
It's on, Garrity thought. It's really on.
When his turn came, the Major gave him number 47 and told him,
good luck.
Up close he smelled very masculine and somehow overpowering. Garrity had an almost insatiable urge to touch the man's leg and make sure he was real. Peter McVries was 61. Hank Olson was 70. He was with the Major longer than the rest. The Major laughed at something Olson said and clapped him on the back. I told him to keep a lot of money on short call, Olson said when he came back. And he told me to give him hell. Said he liked to see someone who was raring to rip. Give him hell, boy, he said.
Pretty good, McVries said, and then winked at Garrity.
Garrity wondered what McVries had meant, winking like that. Was he making fun of Olson? The skinny boy in the tree was named Stebbins. He got his number with his head down, not speaking to the Major at all, and then sat back at the base of his tree. Garrity was somehow fascinated with the boy. Number 100 was a red-headed fellow with a volcanic complexion. His name was Zuck. He got his number, and then they all sat and waited for what would come next. Then 3 soldiers from the half-track passed out wide belts with snap pockets. The pockets were filled with tubes of high-energy concentrate pastes. More soldiers came around with canteens. They buckled on the belts and slung the canteens. Olson slung his belt low on his hips, like a gunslinger, found a wafer chocolate bar, and began to eat it.
Not bad, he said, grinning.
He swigged from his canteen, washing down the chocolate, and Garrity wondered if Olson was just fronting, or if he knew something Garrity did not. The Major looked them over soberly. Garrity's wristwatch said 8:56. How had it gotten so late? His stomach lurched painfully.
All right, fellows. Line up by 10s, please. No particular order. Stay with your friends if you like.
Garrity got up. He felt numb and unreal. It was as if his body now belonged to someone else.
Well, here we go, McVries said at his elbow. Good luck, everyone.
Good luck to you, Garrity said, surprised. McVries said, I need my fucking head examined. He looked suddenly pale and sweaty, not so awesomely fit as he had earlier. He was trying to smile, and not making it. The scar stood out on his cheek like a wild punctuation mark. Stebbins got up and ambled to the rear of the 10-wide, 10-deep queue. Olson, Baker, McVries, and Garrity were in the 3rd row. Garrity's mouth was dry. He wondered if he should drink some water. He decided against it. He had never in his life been so aware of his feet. He wondered if he might freeze and get his ticket on the starting line. He wondered if Stebbins would fold early.
Stebbins, with his jelly sandwich in his purple pants.
He wondered if he would fold up first.
He wondered what it would feel like if...
His wristwatch said 8:59. The major was studying a stainless steel pocket chronometer. He raised his fingers slowly, and everything hung suspended with his hand. The 100 boys watched it carefully, and the silence was awful and immense. The silence was everything. Garrity's watch said 9 o'clock, but the poised hand did not fall.
Do it! Why doesn't he do it?
He felt like screaming it out. Then he remembered that his watch was a minute fast. You could set your watch by the major, only he hadn't. He had forgotten. The major's fingers dropped.
Luck to all, he said.
His face was expressionless, and the reflector sunglasses hid his eyes. They began to walk smoothly, with no jostling. Garrity walked with them. He hadn't frozen. Nobody froze. His feet passed beyond the stone marker, in parade step with McVries on his left and Olson on his right. The sound of feet was very loud.
This is it. This is it. This is it.
A sudden insane urge to stop came to him, just to see if they really meant business. He rejected the thought indignantly and a little fearfully. They came out of the shade and into the sun, the warm spring sun. It felt good. Garrity relaxed, put his hands in his pockets, and kept step with McVries. The group began to spread out, each person finding his own stride and speed. The half-track clanked along the soft shoulder, throwing thin dust. The tiny radar dishes turned busily, monitoring each walker's speed with a sophisticated onboard computer. Low-speed cutoff was exactly 4 miles an hour.
Warning! Warning, 88!
Garrity started and looked around. It was Stebbins. Stebbins was 88. Suddenly, he was sure Stebbins was going to get his ticket right here, still in sight of the starting post.
Smart.
It was Olson.
What?
Garrity asked. He had to make a conscious effort to move his tongue. The guy takes a warning while he's still fresh and gets an idea of where the limit is. And he can slough it easy enough. You walk an hour without getting a fresh warning, you lose one of the old ones. You know that.
Sure I know it, Garrity said.
It was in the rule book. They gave you 3 warnings. The 4th time you fell below 4 miles an hour, you were... well, you were out of the walk. But if you had 3 warnings and could manage to walk for 3 hours, you were back in the sun again.
So now he knows, Olson said. And at 10:02, he's in the clear again.
Garrity walked on at a good clip. He was feeling fine. The starting post dropped from sight as they breasted a hill and began descending into a long pine-studded valley. Here and there were rectangular fields with the earth just freshly turned.
Potatoes, they tell me, McVries said.
Best in the world, Garrity answered automatically.
You from Maine? Baker asked.
Yeah, downstate.
He looked up ahead. Several boys had drawn away from the main group, making perhaps 6 miles an hour. 2 of them were wearing identical leather jackets with what looked like eagles on the back. It was a temptation to speed up, but Garrity refused to be hurried. Conserve energy whenever possible. Hint 13.
Does the road go anywhere near your hometown? McVries asked.
About 7 miles to one side. I guess my mother and my girlfriend will come to see me.
He paused and added carefully.
If I'm still walking, of course.
Hell, there won't be 25 gone when we get downstate, Olson said.
A silence fell among them at that. Garrity knew it wasn't so, and he thought Olson did too. 2 other boys received warnings, and in spite of what Olson had said, Garrity's heart lurched each time. He checked back on Stebbins. He was still at the rear, and eating another jelly sandwich. There was a third sandwich jutting from the pocket of his ragged green sweater. Garrity wondered if his mother had made them, and he thought of the cookies his own mother had given him, pressed on him, as if warding off evil spirits. "Why don't they let people watch the start of a long walk?" Garrity asked.
"Spoils the walker's concentration," a sharp voice said.
Garrity turned his head. It was a small, dark, intense-looking boy with the number 5 pressed to the collar of his jacket. Garrity couldn't remember his name. "Concentration?" he said.
"Yes."
The boy moved up beside Garrity.
"The major has said it is very important to concentrate on calmness at the beginning of a long walk."
He pressed his thumb reflectively against the end of his rather sharp nose. There was a bright red pimple there.
"I agree. Excitement, crowds, TV, later. Right now, all we need to do is focus."
He stared at Garrity with his hooded dark brown eyes and said it again.
"Focus. All I'm focusing on is picking him up and laying him down," Olson said.
5 looked insulted.
"You have to pace yourself. You have to focus on yourself. You have to have a plan. I'm Gary Barkovich, by the way. My home is Washington, D.C.
"I'm John Carter," Olson said. "My home is Barsoom, Mars."
Barkovich curled his lip in contempt and dropped back.
"There's one cuckoo in every clock, I guess," Olson said.
But Garrity thought Barkovich was thinking pretty clearly, at least until one of the guards called out,
"Warning! Warning, 5,
about 5 minutes later.
"I've got a stone in my shoe,"
Barkovich said waspishly. The soldier didn't reply. He dropped off the half-track and stood on the shoulder of the road opposite Barkovich. In his hand, he held a stainless steel chronometer just like the major's. Barkovich stopped completely and took off his shoe. He took a tiny pebble out of it. Dark, intense, his olive sallow face shiny with sweat, he paid no attention when the soldier called out,
"Second warning, 5.
Instead, he smoothed his sock carefully over the arch of his foot.
"Uh-oh," Olson said.
They had all turned around and were walking backward. Stebbins, still at the tag end, walked past Barkovich without looking at him. Now Barkovich was all alone, slightly to the right of the white line, retying his shoe.
"Third warning, 5. Final warning."
There was something in Garrity's belly that felt like a sticky ball of mucus. He didn't want to look, but he couldn't look away. He wasn't conserving energy whenever possible by walking backward, but he couldn't help that either. He could almost feel Barkovich's seconds shriveling away to nothing.
"Oh boy," Olson said. "That dumb shit. He's gonna get his ticket."
But then Barkovich was up. He paused to brush some road dirt from the knees of his pants. Then he broke into a trot, caught up with the group, and settled back into his walking pace. He passed Stebbins, who still didn't look at him, and caught up with Olson. He grinned, brown eyes glittering.
"See? I just got myself a rest. It's all in my plan."
"Maybe you think so," Olson said, his voice higher than usual.
"All I see that you got is 3 warnings. For your lousy minute and a half, you got to walk 3 fucking hours. And why in hell did you need a rest? We just started, for Christ's sake."
Barkovich looked insulted. His eyes burned at Olson.
"We'll see who gets his ticket first, you or me," he said. "It's all in my plan."
"Your plan and the stuff that comes out of my asshole bear a suspicious resemblance to each other," Olson said,
and Baker chuckled. With a snort, Barkovich strode past them. Olson couldn't resist a parting shot.
"Just don't stumble, buddy. They don't warn you again. They just..."
Barkovich didn't even look back, and Olson gave up, disgusted. At 9:13 by Garrity's watch, he had taken the trouble to set it back the 1 minute, the major's jeep breasted the hill they had just started down. He came past them on the shoulder opposite the pacing half-track and raised a battery-powered loudhailer to his lips.
"I'm pleased to announce that you have finished the first mile of your journey, boys. I'd also like to remind you that the longest distance a full complement of walkers has ever covered is 7¾ miles. I'm hoping you'll do better than that."
The jeep spurted ahead. Olson appeared to be considering this news with startled, even fearful wonder. Not even 8 miles, Garrity thought. It wasn't nearly as far as he would have guessed. He hadn't expected anyone, not even Stebbins, to get a ticket until late afternoon at least. He thought of Barkovich. All he had to do was fall below speed once in the next hour. "Ray?" It was Art Baker. He had taken off his coat and slung it over one arm. "Any particular reason you came on the long walk?" Garrity unclipped his canteen and had a quick swallow of water. It was cool and good. It left beads of moisture on his upper lip, and he licked them off. It was good, good to feel things like that. "I don't really know," he said truthfully.
"Me either," Baker thought for a moment.
"Did you go out for track or anything? In school?"
"No."
"Me either. But I guess it don't matter, does it? Not now."
"No, not now," Garrity asked.
Conversation lulled. They passed through a small village with a country store and a gas station. Two old men sat on folding lawn chairs outside the gas station, watching them with hooded and reptilian old men's eyes. On the steps of the country store, a young woman held up her tiny son so he could see them. And a couple of older kids, around 12, Garrity judged, watched them out of sight, wistfully. Some of the boys began to speculate about how much ground they had covered. The word came back that a second pacer half-track had been dispatched to cover the half a dozen boys in the vanguard. They were now completely out of sight. Someone said they were doing 7 miles an hour. Someone else said it was 10. Someone told them authoritatively that a guy up ahead was flagging and had been warned twice. Garrity wondered why they weren't catching up to him if that was true. Olson finished the wafer chocolate bar he had started back at the border and drank some water. Some of the others were also eating, but Garrity decided to wait until he was really hungry. He had heard the concentrates were quite good. The astronauts got them when they went into space. A little after 10 o'clock, they passed a sign that said, "Limestone, 10 miles. Garrity thought about the only long walk his father had ever let him go to. They went to Freeport and watched them walk through. His mother had been with them. The walkers were tired and hollow-eyed and barely conscious of the cheering and the waving signs and the constant hurrah as people cheered on their favorites and those on whom they had wagered. His father told him later that day that people lined the roads from Bangor on. Upcountry, it wasn't so interesting, and the road was strictly cordoned off, maybe so they could concentrate on being calm, as Barkovich had said. But as time passed, it got better, of course. When the walkers passed through Freeport that year, they had been on the road over 72 hours. Garrity had been 10 and overwhelmed by everything. The major had made a speech to the crowd while the boys were still 5 miles out of town. He began with competition, progressed to patriotism, and finished with something called the gross national product. Garrity had laughed at that, because to him, gross meant something nasty, like boogers. He had eaten 6 hot dogs, and when he finally saw the walkers coming, he had wet his pants. One boy had been screaming. That was his most vivid memory. Every time he put his foot down, he had screamed, "I can't! I can't! I can't! I can't!" But he went on walking. They all did, and pretty soon the last of them had gone past L.L. Bean's on US-1 and out of sight. Garrity had been mildly disappointed at not seeing anyone get a ticket. They had never gone to another long walk. Later that night, Garrity had heard his father shouting thickly at someone into the telephone, the way he did when he was being drunk or political, and his mother in the background, her conspiratorial whisper begging him to stop, please stop, before someone picked up the party line. Garrity drank some more water and wondered how Barkovich was making it. They were passing more houses now. Families sat out on their front lawns, smiling, waving, drinking Coca-Colas.
Garrity, McVries said.
My, my, look what you got.
A pretty girl of about 16 in a white blouse and red checkered pedal pushers was holding up a big magic marker sign. Go, go, Garrity, number 47. We love you, Ray. Maine's own. Garrity felt his heart swell. He suddenly knew he was going to win. The unnamed girl proved it. Olson whistled wetly and began to slide his stiff index finger rapidly in and out of his loosely curled fist. Garrity thought that was a pretty goddamn sick thing to be doing. To hell with Hint 13. Garrity ran over to the side of the road. The girl saw his number and squealed. She threw herself at him and kissed him hard. Garrity was suddenly, sweatily aroused. He kissed back, vigorously. The girl poked her tongue into his mouth twice, delicately. Hardly aware of what he was doing, he put one hand on a round buttock and squeezed gently.
Warning! Warning, 47!
Garrity stepped back and grinned.
Thanks. Oh! Oh! Oh, sure.
Her eyes were starry. He tried to think of something else to say, but he could see the soldier opening his mouth to give him the second warning. He trotted back to his place, panting a little and grinning. He felt a little guilty after Hint 13 just the same, though. Olson was also grinning.
For that, I would have taken 3 warnings.
Garrity didn't answer, but he turned around and walked backward and waved to the girl. When she was out of sight, he turned around and began to walk firmly. An hour before his warning would be gone. He must be careful not to get another one. But he felt good. He felt fit. He felt like he could walk all the way to Florida. He started to walk faster.
Ray, McVries was still smiling. What's your hurry?
Yeah, that was right. Hint 6. Slow and easy does it.
Thanks.
McVries went on smiling.
Don't thank me too much. I'm out to win, too.
Garrity stared at him, disconcerted.
I mean, let's not put this on a 3-musketeer basis. I like you, and it's obvious you're a big hit with the pretty girls. But if you fall over, I won't pick you up.
Yeah. He smiled back, but his smile felt lame.
On the other hand, Baker drawled softly, we're all in this together, and we might as well keep each other amused.
McVries smiled.
Why not?
They came to an upslope and saved their breath for walking. Halfway up, Garrity took off his jacket and slung it over his shoulder. A few moments later, they passed someone's discarded sweater, lying on the road. Someone, Garrity thought, is going to wish they had that tonight. Up ahead, a couple of the point walkers were losing ground. Garrity concentrated on picking them up and putting them down. He still felt good. He felt strong. Chapter 2
I'm Harkness, number 49. You're Garrity. Number 47, right?
Garrity looked at Harkness, who wore glasses and had a crew cut. Harkness's face was red and sweaty.
That's right.
Harkness had a notebook. He wrote Garrity's name and number in it. The script was strange and jerky, bumping up and down as he walked. He ran into a fellow named Collie Parker, who told him to watch where the fuck he was going. Garrity suppressed a smile. "I'm taking down everyone's name and number," Harkness said. When he looked up, the mid-morning sun sparkled on the lenses of his glasses, and Garrity had to squint to see his face. It was 10:30, and they were 8 miles out of Limestone, and they had only 1.75 miles to go to beat the record of the farthest distance traveled by a complete long walk group. "I suppose you're wondering why I'm writing down everyone's name and number," Harkness said.
"You're with the squads," Olson cracked over his shoulder.
"No, I'm going to write a book," Harkness said pleasantly. "When this is all over, I'm going to write a book."
Garrity grinned. "If you win, you're going to write a book, you mean?"
Harkness shrugged. "Yes, I suppose. But look at this. A book about the long walk from an insider's point of view could make me a rich man."
McVries burst out laughing. "If you win, you won't need a book to make you a rich man, will you?"
Harkness frowned. "Well, I suppose not. But it would still make one heck of an interesting book, I think."
They walked on, and Harkness continued taking names and numbers. Most gave them willingly enough, joshing him about the great book. Now they had come 6 miles. The word came back that it looked good for breaking the record. Garrity speculated briefly on why they should want to break the record anyhow. The quicker the competition dropped out, the better the odds became for those remaining. He supposed it was a matter of pride. The word also came back that thunder showers were forecast for the afternoon. Someone had a transistor radio, Garrity supposed. If it was true, it was bad news. Early May thunder showers weren't the warmest. They kept walking. McVries walked firmly, keeping his head up and swinging his arms slightly. He had tried the shoulder, but fighting the loose soil there had made him give it up. He hadn't been warned, and if the knapsack was giving him any trouble or chafing, he showed no sign. His eyes were always searching the horizon. When they passed small clusters of people, he waved and smiled his thin-lipped smile. He showed no signs of tiring. Baker ambled along, moving in a kind of knee-bent shuffle that seemed to cover the ground when you weren't looking. He swung his coat idly, smiled at the pointing people, and sometimes whistled a low snatch of some tune or other. Garrity thought he looked like he could go on forever. Olson wasn't talking so much anymore, and every few moments he would bend one knee swiftly. Each time, Garrity could hear the joint pop. Olson was stiffening up a little, Garrity thought, beginning to show 6 miles of walking. Garrity judged that one of his canteens must be almost empty. Olson would have to pee before too long. Barkovich kept up the same jerky pace, now ahead of the main group as if to catch up with the vanguard walkers, now dropping back towards Stebbins' position on drag. He lost one of his three warnings and gained it back 5 minutes later. Garrity decided he must like it there on the edge of nothing. Stebbins just kept on walking off by himself. Garrity hadn't seen him speak to anybody. He wondered if Stebbins was lonely or tired. He still thought Stebbins would fold up early, maybe first, although he didn't know why he thought so. Stebbins had taken off the old green sweater, and he carried the last jelly sandwich in his hand. He looked at no one. His face was a mask. They walked on. The road was crossed by another, and policemen were holding up traffic as the walkers passed. They saluted each walker, and a couple of the boys, secure in their immunity, thumbed their noses. Garrity didn't approve. He smiled and nodded to acknowledge the police, and wondered if the police thought they were all crazy. The cars honked, and then some woman yelled out to her son. She had parked beside the road, apparently waiting to make sure her boy was still along for the walk.
"Percy! Percy!"
It was 31. He blushed, then waved a little, and then hurried on with his head slightly bent. The woman tried to run out into the road. The guards on the top deck of the half-track stiffened, but one of the policemen caught her arm and restrained her gently. Then the road curved, and the intersection was out of sight. They passed across a wooden slatted bridge. A small brook gurgled.